Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, January 19, 2025. My name's Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and your moderator for this morning. The share IDs for Friday, January 17th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,089, that's 22,089. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,090, that's 22,090. This morning, A Vision for You presents Living Spiritual Principles in Families and Relationships. The 12th step states, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. The 12th step sums up our 12-step recovery program as a lifetime undertaking based on the practice of spiritual principles and service to others. Bill Wilson writes, the joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and action is its key word. Here, we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. The transforming power of the 12 steps is now focused on the whole life, in our homes, with our families, and the myriad of relationships within our work life and life affairs. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous puts it this way: we feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. This essentially says that it's great and necessary to practice the spiritual principles with our sponsor, with our friends, within recovery settings to maintain our recovery. But it is even more important to practice the spiritual principles outside of recovery environments. We demonstrate these principles by taking the lessons, insights, and tools that we acquire through working the 12 steps into every single part of our internal world and everything we do in our daily lives. In our recovery, we now move to a larger, more encompassing dimension, the world of the spirit. The principles embodied in the 12 steps are to be applied in all of our interactions and activities in our lives on a daily basis. In fact, it becomes the design of our lives. As we practice and work each of the 12 steps, we are learning a new perspective, a new life skill, and adding new tools to our spiritual toolbox, all of which better equips us to handle life with lovingness, with tolerance, with serenity, and effectiveness with our families and all our relationships. Joining us today to speak on this very topic are three recovered compulsive overeaters. This morning, we have Jason K.P. from Pennsylvania, Rachel K.P. from Pennsylvania, and Phoebe B. from Vermont. And it's with great excitement and appreciation that I welcome Jason P. as panelist number one. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Leah. Good morning, everybody on the line and listening to this in a recorded fashion. I am Jason K.P. I'm a recovered compulsive eater and bulimic from Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia. And if you're wondering, Rachel KP is my wife. She's also in Philadelphia area on the second floor of this home with the baby, who's 5 months old. So we're going to be talking, as I'm thinking of this, I'm feeling like, you know, I get the first crack at this, and then Rachel gets the rebuttal, so she can correct anything that I say that she finds is wrong or misleading. But thank you, Leah, for so much for framing this discussion. And, you know, this is a continuation of last week's talk, in a sense, the same theme that Allison gave, so I appreciate having some continuity there. We are talking about living spiritual principles in our homes and relationships, you know, so when we walk into that door, the family life, our family obligations, are we living by spiritual principles? Are we focused on giving rather than getting? Are we practicing unselfishness, kindness? One quote from the chapter, The Family Afterwards, which is where I'll focus some of my quotes from, says, a spiritual life does not include our family obligations, may not be so perfect at all. And I'm going to give some quotes from the big book and some anecdotes of different experiences and how I practice these principles in this family realm and relationship realm. And Rachel and I did meet in recovery. So we met at the OA birthday party and really connected many years ago. We were friends for some time. We developed a relationship. She moved from Colorado to here in Pennsylvania. And then Phoebe, I think, has an important perspective as well with a partner who's not in recovery. She's going to go third, and she's in a little bit of a different life stage with grown children out of the house. So looking forward to Phoebe's talk as well. So in The Family Afterwards, it talks about members of the family should meet together on common grounds of tolerance, understanding, and love. This involves a process of deflation. For me, that means setting aside our ego, being humble. It says members of the family may have fixed ideas about the family's attitude towards himself or herself. Each one is interested in having his or her wishes respected. It says we find the more one member of the family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. And why? Each person wants to play the lead. They're trying to arrange the family show to his liking. Is he not unconsciously trying to see what he can take from the family rather than give? So the principle within this is giving rather than taking, giving rather than getting. To me, this sounds a little bit like the St. Francis prayer, and that's been a big prayer for me lately. And this very much mimics pages 60 to 63 in the big book about the third step, but it's basically saying, here's the third step in the family life. Are we trying to direct the show? Are we trying to be in control? Do we have this script that we think everybody should abide by? And if they did, everything would be well. So one example of this for me and Rachel was kind of interesting. I had a certain story, a certain demand in mind, and Rachel had her own sort of ideas. I came home from work, and I'm saying, I haven't seen the baby all day long. I just want to connect with him. I just want to play with him. I came in the playroom door to find Rachel and shut the door ever so lightly. And, you know, she may say I slammed it, but I definitely did not slam it. But, you know, she'll get the rebuttal here. The baby kind of startled awake. He wasn't really asleep. So in my mind, I'm like, he's not really sleeping. Let me hold him. Let me play with him. As I start sort of like smiling, talking, you know, engaging him, Rachel's like, Jason, he needs to sleep. And my script is, Rachel, he needs to play with his dad. So we started to have an interesting little conversation about this. And I think I started feeling resistant, you know. And I joke around with Rachel sometimes, and I say, don't tell me what to do, and I'm mostly joking. There's some truth to it. And after we kind of had this conversation, I could kind of feel some tension and some fear and some, you know, resistance, and I asked Rachel, like, can we pause and come back to this in 5 or 10 minutes? I said, you know, I feel like we're not really getting anywhere. You know, and this is a spiritual principle, to pause when agitated or doubtful. This is talked about in step 11. We pause when agitated or doubtful and ask God for the next thought or action, for the next thought or action. So we gave it some time, and Rachel came back in. She said, you know, she apologized. She admitted she was 100% wrong and I was right. No, just kidding. We didn't do that. But she did apologize, and she kind of said, I'm sorry. I just had these ideas. I just wanted him to, you know, sleep, and I said, yeah, I know, okay, but it seemed like you didn't need to sleep. And, you know, we just had a very loving, kind conversation, and I did use some humor to sort of, like, break the ice. You know, I said, Rachel, this is how mad you were, and I said, this is what your face looked like, and I started contorting my face and, like holding my breath and just, like, giving her the side eye, and, like, and she's laughing because she's, like, the sweetest, kindest, like, most innocent, loving, you know, person, you know, so she doesn't get mad like that. So it's, you know, we're just laughing and just, you know, having fun. And humor for me is a huge thing. You know, Bill talks about it in this chapter. It says, we are not a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. It says, we do not indulge in cynicism over the state of nations. We don't carry the world's trouble on our shoulders. You know, we help alcoholics. We may recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. And Bill uses that word a lot in this book. He doesn't say right or wrong necessarily. A lot of times he's saying we're trying to be useful to others. It says, we burst into merriment over seemingly tragic experiences out of the past. Why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and been given the power to help others. And that's a really great statement. It's a really great promise of some of the power that we have to help others. It says, people in bad health and those who seldom play do not laugh much. So it's literally telling us to play together. We're sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And again, this chapter has really great little gems in it. It says, you know, we do not subscribe to the belief that life is a veil of tears, though it once was for many of us. It's clear we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid, then, the deliberate manufacture of misery, but if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize on it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. So when troubles come, we demonstrate God's power. And for me, I like to say God is bigger than any problem I have in this life. You know, God is the rock, the cornerstone. You know, so there's just so many really, really great gems in this chapter. I do want to say, you know, as you get into this chapter of as you're studying it, I would always encourage you to do everything the book asks from the doctor's opinion to here. This chapter is meant to speak to somebody who has put down the food, who has recovered to some extent. So just want to maybe make that kind of point. But again, like this insistence, excuse me, this insistence that we enjoy life is really important. You know, for me, in my selfishness, I'm trying to take on, you know, the concerns of the world. I'm caught up in self-centered thinking, and in me, in humor, which is a constant for me, in playfulness. Like, I'm so playful. I think for me, it's a God-given trait, and I feel close to my higher power. You know, so I'm constantly, you know, joking with Rachel. You know, we're having these wrestling matches in the living room. Of course, I'm using about 10% of my strength and, you know, trying not to hurt her. You know, practical jokes, you know, I call her up and say, hey, you know, I'm stuck at work, I'll be another hour. And in reality, I'm pulling up to the house and I come in and find her and, you know, tell her I tricked her. And, you know, we just laugh. It's just super, super important. So I wanted to talk more of this principle of focused on giving rather than getting. So I had recently watched this like social media video and I was so touched by it. And this father was talking about how every day he comes home, his little daughter, you know, without fail is meeting him at the door, smiling. And I've seen some other videos, you know, the wife is meeting the father at the door, you know, just smiling, dancing, showering him with love and affection. And I said, Rachel, isn't this amazing? I really would like it if you did that. You know, she's been staying at home with the baby, so this paradigm fits of me coming home, you know, her being at home. And, you know, and she was like, yeah, it's, you know, that's a nice thing. Now, this in practice was not working. Rachel is not a great multitasker, so she'd be busy with something. She wouldn't remember to kind of put something down and come meet me. I'd be on the phone coming in and she wouldn't want to interrupt me, you know, and be like, no, just interrupt me. And, you know, she'd be off with the baby, baby sleeping on her, you know, she's nap trapped is what she calls it. And so we had this constant, you know, almost every day, every other day, Rachel, remember, meet me at the door. smiling, looking cute with the baby, this image of like King Jason comes home and the subjects of his realm, come to meet him and celebrate him. So I had this sort of moment as I was crossing the threshold of the house, the seven step or the St. Francis prayer kind of came to mind, and I said, I'm so focused on giving of I'm sorry, I'm so focused on getting rather than giving. And I said, this is not working for us. And I said, I need to be the change that I want to see. I need to focus on this value that I am seeing of, we reconnect as a family after a time of being apart in a little ritualistic fashion. The funny thing is I'm terrible at this. I'm actually not great at coming home, setting down, my stuff and running to Rachel with love and affection and appreciation and adoration. So that's extremely humbling what I had sort of demanded of her. I could not provide. So it's just really, really interesting. Another little reflection that I had was around words of affirmation. Rachel had said that, words of affirmation are, her key love language. And I just, it's not one of mine, and so it doesn't come naturally for me necessarily. But it does come natural with our dogs, and it does come very naturally with the baby. So I was noticing a pattern. So I'd be going to bed at night, and Rachel goes to bed later than me. So, and I put the dogs to bed, and I'd say, to my dogs, what a sweet, precious little doggy you are. I just love you so much. You're such a sweet little precious little innocent little guy. I'm just gonna take care of you the rest of your life, and I just love you so much. And then I'd go to the baby and I'd say, you're just the love of my life. I love your precious little blue eyes. You make me smile so much. And then I go to Rachel, good night, honey, and give her a kiss on the cheek. And so I had to make a commitment to give my wife more words of affirmation than the dogs and the baby. And again, it was just a thoughtlessness, a lack of care and consideration and compassion. And I also wanted to talk about 10 steps. 10 steps are really key for me, and many, many times the content of the 10th step is something relational. I'm having fear about, my sleep, the baby's sleep, the family obligations, Rachel's schedule, my schedule, fear that I'm not going to get what I want. The other day she posted, I was at work in a little downtime, and it said, it had an image of the wife being awake, the husband snoring. I just kind of felt offended. I'm like, I have all these, like this CPAP machine and all this like dental appliance I paid like $4,000 out of pocket for. Like, I'm trying to stop my snoring. And I'm like, I want to be engaged. I don't want to be this, oblivious husband who's like snoring away while the wife is awake all night. And I had recently been getting up at like 3 in the morning so I could have a shift, So I kind of felt offended, and I was starting to send her a text and be like, hey, I want to talk about this. And I practiced a pause, a restraint of pen and tongue, and I reached out to somebody and I did a 10th step. It took the edge off. It took this sense of like, Jason, maybe you're overthinking this. Like, maybe she just thought it was funny. Like, for me, I'm impulsive. Like, I want to text, and I know sometimes like a phone call is much better, more personal. So I called her and I said, hey, I saw that, I saw that. Tell me about it. And she just laughed. She's like, oh yeah, I thought it was funny. She's like, it seems like every time I bring the baby back to bed, somehow you're snoring. And the truth of the matter is I have a CPAP machine and I take it off. And I have this sleep appliance and I take it out sometimes and I do snore. And this is her experience. And I said, yeah, it's funny. I was a little offended by it because I've been trying really hard. I really want to be this engaged husband. I really want to help you. And she says, she just said, I know, that's a sensitivity of yours. And, I don't know if she apologized or not, or just, but it was a conversation of just such tremendous respect and understanding. And then I just want to share one more story, and I think this is just to, and then I'll finish up. And this is just to sort of talk about, spirituality, sometimes I see a rigidity in 12-step programs of like, this is the 10 steps and the prayers and like, we have these practices, but for me, a spiritual way of living is just part of who I am, and it comes out in many ways. Like even at work, it comes out as like, I just love the people I work for and with, like, and this feeling of love is like, powerful and overwhelming. And one morning I, the baby was in his crib. He started crying. It was my turn. I picked him up and I just started to feel this sense of overwhelming love. And, we have a full length mirror in the bathroom and I just was looking in the mirror with him and he's just looking at me with his big blue eyes. And my heart is just breaking open with just this tremendous sense of love. And then I started to think about, did my father love me this much? And I've been talking to my mom recently about my dad and saying like, he's passed away. Was he really an engaged father? Was he really, really, engaged? Did he really love us as babies and like care for us? And she's 100% sure he did. And I started to think, even if my dad loved me an eighth or a fourth or a half of what I was feeling, I was so loved, more than I ever known, by my father, and he just couldn't express it. And I started to trust that. And this healing was happening inside of me of like healing this relationship with my father. We made amends. We were really at peace before he passed, but there's a deeper, deeper healing. And, and I talked to him and we named my son after him. But then something deeper was happening in me about, does my higher power think of me in this way? Does my higher power love me in this way? And again, the tears are just coming and my heart is so open and I've never experienced a love like this in my entire life, and it's just so powerful. And I've been praying and inviting God into my heart as an energy of love and compassion and mercy and care, because I need a higher power like that, because I'm so hard on myself. And so my second step was deepening as I'm saying, okay, God, like, do you see me as the father sees the child? Is this love I have in my heart the same love you have for me? And I just had to trust and believe that it was, and I look at this little baby and I just see that he's somehow transforming and changing me as a person. Somehow the love I feel inside, is changing. It's changing and healing things I didn't know needed to be healed, and transforming me in ways I didn't know were possible, and opening my heart to love in a way that I didn't know was possible. And none of this would be possible without recovery in the first place. I wouldn't be a present father. I might not even be alive, honestly. I wouldn't be in a healthy relationship to bring a son into the world. So, spirituality for me, I find it all over. It's practicing within the confines of my home is extremely important. So my time is just about up. I think I'm at a good stopping point. I appreciate everybody for listening. And I'm going to go grab the baby and pass it off to Rachel. And hopefully she treats me kindly with her rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason, for your beautiful share. Yes, now we will welcome panelist number two, Rachel KP from Pennsylvania. Good morning, Rachel.
Hey, good morning. This is Rachel KP, recovery compulsive overeater in Pennsylvania, as Jason mentioned. You might hear some creaking as I walk up the steps, just for some privacy. I'm just going to very quickly qualify. So I have been in OA and abstinent for over 6 years now, and I did do a special edition a while ago that has my story if anybody wants to listen to that. I'm originally from Colorado, and I, as Jason mentioned, I moved out here to Pennsylvania, and Jason and I met in the rooms. So perspective as partners who are both in recovery and how we navigate spiritual principles in our relationship. And then excited to hear from Phoebe as well, with a little bit of a different perspective. But you know, my message and sharing some of my own examples and, you know, quotes from the book and how I relate those into my life and in our lives is really that, you know, the things that I practice and that we practice, you know, are accessible not only for people who, you know, where both partners are in recovery, but where there's only one partner in recovery. I wanted to start with kind of sharing about, you know, what I was like with relationships before I got recovered. And, you know, immediately when we talked about this topic, the bedevilments came to mind, right? Many of you may be familiar. So in We Agnostics on page 52 are the bedevilments. And here kind of in the middle of the page, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? So in my copy of my big book, with each of these bedevilments, I have a check mark next to each one of them because I relate to each one of them. And for me, left to my own devices, right, without a spiritual program, without these 12 steps in the food, this is how I show up in relationships. I checked every single one of those things. And that's my reality, right? I believe I could not have been a healthy partner in an unrecovered state. Now, I meet a lot of people in OA who, you know, have been in decades-long marriages, you know, who came into recovery years and years after getting married. And certainly the 12 steps has, like, drastically improved their relationships. But just my story is that I could not show up and look somebody in the eye and be authentically myself and communicate in a healthy way with a partner in an unrecovered state. I was so encumbered by the shame of compulsive eating that I could not show up as authentically myself. And so I just wanted to share that piece. But that's kind of my reality. Also on page 61 in How It Works, you know, just to speak a little bit more to kind of how I am without a program. At the top of page 61, that first paragraph, in trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. So for me personally, I was the person who was kind, considerate, patient, generous, modest, and self-sacrificing. I very rarely was the mean, egotistical, selfish, dishonest person. Growing up in school, I would, you know, whenever we would have like superlatives or, you know, people would compliment me on qualities about myself, I would always hear, "You're so nice, you're so nice," right? And that's how I, you know, showed up and still show up to a certain degree. You know, I'm that person who is so generous to other people. You know, before I got recovered, I was always like baking things for people and like bringing them to work or to school or to friends. Of course, I was like eating like half of what I was baking, and that was a big part of my disease. But, you know, I was just always somebody who is so kind and generous. And, you know, and I always thought, you know, before I read this paragraph, before I did this work, I thought, oh, I'm just such a nice person, you know. But I realized as a result of doing this work is that was manipulation. You know, I was people pleasing because I wanted something out of it, because I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to be lonely. I wanted approval from other people. I was basically making other people my God. So that's really how I show up in an unrecovered state. And, you know, by the time Jason and I met, it was at the birthday party in 2019. And shout out to everybody who's at the birthday party now. Maybe some are listening. I hope you're having an amazing time. I wish we could be there, but we have a little baby, so we decided not to go this year. So when Jason and I met at the birthday party, I can visualize us now sitting down in the lobby of the Hilton, and you know, Jason was being a little flirty with me, right? He told me that, sorry, I'm getting over a cold. He told me that he, you know, kind of went to some of these events and was looking for a partner. He was looking for a life partner, and he really wanted to be with somebody who was in OA, you know, who was working in 12-step program. And he asked me, you know, don't you want to date somebody? Don't you want to be with somebody who is, something to this effect, but who is in recovery? And I remember telling him, you know, it would be really nice, but I don't think it's necessary. You know, I think it's, you know, a partner who's not in the 12 steps, they can understand to a certain extent. They don't have that lived experience, but they can, you know, learn a little bit about the work and can be understanding of it. And that conversation just really sticks out to me, because when he and I met, I was dating somebody else who was not in recovery. And that person was really understanding and, you know, so accepting of my 12-step work. And then a few years later, when Jason and I, you know, were both single and, you know, started dating, I'm so grateful that he and I are both in recovery. We both, you know, speak the language of the heart. Again, I don't think it's necessary. I still stand by that. I don't think it's necessary, but it is really nice to share in that. You know, when we first started dating, I think I was the one to initiate this, but I was like, oh, I would love to read each other's, you know, sex inventory. And so he had a Google Doc. He sent me his sex inventory. I took a picture of my notebook, my sex inventory I had written, and the first time I worked the steps. And we shared that with each other. We discussed it, and we talked about, like, our ideal partnerships and, you know, what we wanted in relationships and, you know, how we wanted to show up in relationships as guided by our higher powers. And that was really meaningful. You know, I imagine that with a partner who is not in recovery, it could still be possible to share that, right? To explain, you know, this is part of my work, you know, it may be vulnerable to share that. But it was a really meaningful experience for us to share that with each other. I wanted to kind of circle back to what Jason had said, what Jason was talking about earlier about a recent fight we had. I'm just checking my time. And I wouldn't even call it a fight. I don't think we really even fight. We just kind of have, you know, disagreements, and I can't remember a time that we've ever yelled at each other. You know, and that's in large part just our personalities, but also like this having shared in this work. But you know, my side of it, okay, you're going to see that I'm right in this situation. No, just kidding. But yeah, he came home from work. He came into the playroom where I was holding the baby. I just finished feeding him, and he was like so close to falling asleep, and he needed a nap because he hadn't slept in a few hours, and his wake windows are like 2 hours at most. And you know, Jason came in, and the baby's eyes like startled awake, and he started like trying to play with the baby and getting him all excited, and I was like, he needs to sleep. And Jason took him and was like engaging him, and I was really like huffy and short with him, and you know, I was showing up as somebody I don't usually show up as, right? I was angry. I rarely get angry. And Jason asked for a 5-minute break, because you know, we were just kind of going back and forth, and I wanted to be right. You know, I wanted him to see my way. But I was like, oh, fine. So we took a 5-minute break, and I had this kind of anxious, angry energy, and I went to go and wash dishes and, you know, be of service to our household. We don't have a dishwasher in our home, unfortunately, so we're always washing dishes. So I was washing dishes, and, you know, I could have worked a 10-step about it, and that, you know, that would have been a good thing to do in that moment. But because we were coming back in 5 minutes, I decided not to, you know, call somebody and do a 10-step. But what I did do is took some deep breaths. I said the sick man's prayer about Jason. And I really tried to keep in mind the St. Francis prayer, which Jason referred to earlier. And for those who aren't familiar, the St. Francis prayer is on page 99 of the AA 12 and 12. And my favorite line in this prayer is, Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand rather than to be understood, to love than to be loved. So in that moment, even though I really didn't want to, I tried to understand Jason's point of view, right? And I kind of talked from my higher powers, kind of intuitive thought in my mind. You know, what I kind of heard or what I worked through in my mind is, you know, Jason's been gone all day. He finds so much joy in interacting with the baby. You know, I get to see the baby all day long when I'm, you know, not working. He really wants to spend time with our baby, right? And so I brought in the spirit of that St. Francis prayer, and then I started to feel kind of more calm and more looseness around it. And then a little bit later, you know, we came back together, and even though I didn't want to, I apologized. And I was like, I'm sorry I was short with you. I owned my part in it, right? My side of it. And owned up for that. You know, I'm not going to apologize for something that I didn't do. I'm not going to say I was, you know, I was totally wrong. You know, the baby didn't need to sleep, you know, because that was my truth. Like, that was what I believed to be true. But I did own my part in it. Like, I'm sorry I was short with you. I'm sorry I was angry. And what I often find in our marriage and when we have disagreements, when I, you know, when we go away for a little bit, you know, we each do some of our own work, right? Maybe it's 10th step, maybe it's some prayer. And then come back, and when one of us apologizes, that opens a window for us to then communicate at a better level and to understand each other. So as a result of me apologizing, then he expressed understanding of where I was at, right? We each kind of explained, this is what I was feeling, this is what I was thinking, this is my experience, right? So we understood each other even more deeply. And then we came to a solution, right? Okay, let's, how about, you know, Jason, I think a little bit later, then he put the baby, you know, he strapped the baby to his chest, right, with their baby carrier, right? And then he took a nap. So, you know, as a result of coming together, one of us apologizing, and then usually both of us apologizing as a result, right, understanding each other more deeply, then we kind of what happens in our relationship is, you know, we're able to come to those solutions really well once we're able to kind of understand each other more deeply. In our marriage, you know, we do this work, right, and we do 10 steps with each other a lot. Jason is my favorite 10-step partner. He told me last night, I'm not his favorite 10-step partner, but whatever, Jason. So we often do 10 steps together. And as a result of that, you know, whether it's a 10th step or just kind of talking through what's going on for us, we really deeply understand each other's patterns, right, our psychological patterns and our defects of character, if you will. So, you know, he really understands for me that when I feel angry or like I'm being criticized, I start to shut down. And it's hard for me to even articulate what I want to say. You know, that's one of my patterns. I also, when I feel like I'm being criticized, sometimes I get defensive, right? And I really want to be heard. Sometimes I come from a really emotional place, right? Whereas one of Jason's patterns is that he's hyper-logical, right? And he often comes from a rigid, like logical place. So we really understand, you know, our patterns and how our brains work. And so what we're able to do with each other is, you know, he may say to me when we're kind of having a disagreement about something and I'm starting to shut down, right? I'm not making eye contact with him. I'm kind of getting quiet. He's like, are you shutting down right now? Right? Because he can see that in me. He knows that pattern. He sees what's going on for me. And I'll say, yes, I feel like I'm shutting down right now, you know, and then maybe we'll take a break and then we'll come back a little bit later once we have a little bit of time to process. For me, I'm a little bit of a slower processor. It takes me some time to really sit with things and wrap my head around, you know, how I feel about it, what I think about it. For him, he's a very fast processor, right? So sometimes we need that space and then to come back. I also wanted to share just a way in which, you know, spirituality has shown up for us and our 12-step work has shown up for us in our lives. This really profound experience where, we were having our baby back in August, We were in the hospital, and we were just soon before the baby came out, right? I did the birth without any kind of epidural or anything, totally natural, and it was, as you can imagine, very painful. And it was that kind of that last part, the transition piece of labor, where the baby was about to come, and you know, I said, like, I can't do this, you know, which is very common. That just that peak of pain, and I and our doula, who the doula was on one side of me, Jason was on another side of me. The doula was like, remember, you told me that prayer helps you when you're struggling. And in that moment, Jason and I together said the serenity prayer and the third step prayer. And very soon after, you know, our baby was born. And that moment was just so profound for me. You know, I'll always remember that, where like we have that shared spiritual life, and we were able to say those prayers together. And, you know, for me, it's really important whether I'm saying the serenity prayer, the third step prayer, the St. Francis prayer, the seventh step prayer, you know, the sick man's prayer. It's not just about reciting the words. It's about the message of the prayer, right? And so, again, in the AA 12 and 12 and step 11, Bill W. suggests that we, you know, take these prayers, for example, the St. Francis prayer, and really meditate on that, really let that message sink in. And that was just such a profound experience, right? Applying the serenity prayer, applying the third step prayer to this experience of giving birth to our child. I have so much more I could share, you know, from the family afterward, but I know I'm running low on time here, so I'll get through what I can. But I wanted to highlight on page 127 here in the family afterward, a little more than halfway down the page. Since the home has suffered more than anything else, it is well that a man exert himself here. He is not likely to get far in any direction if he fails to show unselfishness and love under his own roof. So with this, I just, you know, what stuck out to me here was, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, working my program. And actually, Jason and Melissa C. did a special edition about this a little while ago, about like the program versus our life. And spoiler alert, how, you know, they're not separate, right? And that's what I really thought of as I read this paragraph is, you know, my program is my life. My life is my program, right? So when I'm, you know, at home, when I'm taking care of the baby, right, I'm feeding him, I'm rocking him to sleep, I'm playing with him, right, I'm taking care of his needs, right, taking care of our dog's needs, taking care of Jason's needs, right, being of service to him, that's me working my program, right, because it's about these spiritual principles, right, it's about working these steps, practicing these principles in all our affairs, right, so at the end of the day, if I haven't done one outreach call, if I haven't gone to a meeting that day, it's not a loss, right? I have worked my program because I have been of service to my family, right? I take those spiritual principles, I apply them to every facet of my life. And I think I'm about out of time there. So again, there's a lot more I could share about, you know, my immediate family, my siblings, my father. But I really did, I decided to focus on our marriage here, and excited to hear Phoebe talk more about several different relationships in her life, and I'm looking forward to the Q&A as well. So with that, I will pass.
Thank you. Jason. Oh. Sorry. Thank you, Rachel KP, for your touching share. Yes, and now we welcome panelist number three, Phoebe B. from Vermont. Good morning, Phoebe. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Leia. And thank you, Jason and Rachel. That was very wonderful. So I'm going to give you a little bit of information about me, just context information. I am a recovered food addict, compulsive overeater. I've been abstinent for 8.5 years, maintaining approximately a 100-pound weight loss. I'm 2 months shy of 75. I've been married for 27 years. It's a second marriage. We have a blended family. I have one daughter, two stepdaughters, four grandchildren. I am retired. I retired 5 years ago. and I just want to say, related to something that Rachel just said, you know, we work the steps to live the steps. And that's why I do this program. I have a wonderful life now, and I am in a relationship where my husband is not in 12-step recovery. And I am going to read what I've written because that's just my style. I'm a little bit more comfortable reading than just speaking off the cuff. So none of what I'm going to talk about would be possible without entire abstinence, as Dr. Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion. And Rachel referred to, you know, not jumping right to the family afterward until you've actually worked through the steps. And Joe and Charlie talk about that. They talk about the big book as being a textbook. And you don't take algebra jumping into the last part of algebra before you've had the first part of algebra. So what I did was I wrote down the 12 principles of the program, one for each step. And this is not in any particular order. I'm not doing all 12. I'm only doing a few, because I have some specific examples from relationships in my family related to these principles. So the first principle I'm going to talk about is honesty. So early in recovery was the first time I went through the steps in entire abstinence. I'd been through the steps several times, but I was not entirely abstinent. So what grew out of that working through the steps was that I needed to be honest with my husband about my overspending. I had two credit cards I had that he didn't know about, and they were both maxed out. And the big book on page 24 says, who wants to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess his faults to another and make restitution for harm done? Well, those were my directions, though. I needed to do those things. It was mortifying. And it was hard. And money is and always has been one of our hot spots. With God's help, I admitted it all to him and what my plan was to pay them off. And it took 2 years to do that. Going forward, we made a commitment to have regular financial conversations. And they don't always go well. And with each year, they get better. Being honest about fears, and my husband is much better about being honest about his fears because I've been more honest about my fears and attempting to be loving and tolerant. To stay entirely abstinent, the directions tell me I must be rigorously honest no matter how mortifying. So the next principle I'm going to talk about is surrender. For a number of years in the early 2000s until her death in 2010, my brothers and I navigated the very difficult long goodbye of my mom's decline into Alzheimer's. I was not in recovery at that time. And as it says on pages 60 and 61 in the big book, I was the director, wanting to arrange everything. And I was kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. And I was also mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. That caused terrible fissures and fractures with my three brothers and my one sister-in-law. Thankfully, as a result of my work through the steps, relationships had been repaired by February 2020, when my favorite brother, my youngest brother, David, died. Because of that work and the grace of God, I was able to be intimately involved in David's final days. Soon after David's death, my sister-in-law asked me to come to their house to talk about David's service. The suggestion had been that my other two brothers and I write a composite to share at the service. All three of us were uncomfortable with that. In fact, one of my brothers got kind of hot under the collar about that. And so I was delegated to talk to my sister-in-law and her kids about that. We each had such different relationships with David, so I was anxious about sharing that because my sister-in-law and I had been estranged for a while, but we were coming back together. So I took the car to drive over the mountain on a beautiful sunny day. It was a beautiful snowy landscape, and I felt God's presence. I prayed, God, help me know what to do. And the answer I got was, you will know what and when to say something. So I listened to beautiful music for the hour drive, and as it says on page 96 in the AA 12 and 12, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. When I got there, we started talking about the service, and I said, I'd like to explore our part. My nephew said, what do you need? I told about our different relationships and how we were struggling with, and he said, what do you need in terms of time? I said, about 5 minutes each. He said, done. They all said, done. And my sister-in-law said, thank you for your honesty. Surrender to my higher power allowed me to be honest. So the next principle is courage. In the big book on page 68, it says, the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. We let him demonstrate through us that he, what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have me be. Last spring, I felt ready to do an amends with my oldest brother from something that happened in 1987, a 30-year-old amends. For about 10 days, I wrote on this, and I read the writing to my sponsor every day and went through a process asking myself questions. What do I remember that happened? How did it look from my perspective? How did it look from Lon's perspective? That's my brother's name. How did it feel to me? How did it feel to Lon? Or how did I think it felt to Lon? What harms did I think I had done to Lon? What harms had I done to myself? And what harms did I do to our relationship? Each day, I asked God to remove my fear and to help me be rigorously honest in my writing. After all the questions, I wrote out an amends. All my writing was run by my sponsor, and my amends was about a half a page. So I contacted him, and I made a time to talk. I said, you know, there's something I'd really like to talk to you about. And I had to do it by FaceTime because he lives out of the country. And so I shared with him that I was going to read the amends. And at the end, I asked him, is there anything that I missed? And he did share some things with me, and we talked about those, and we kind of explored those. But he was blown away, and we both cried, and we do feel closer to each other. It wasn't perfect, but it laid the groundwork for me to do a living amends with him this summer. My brother is a dual citizen in Peru and the U.S. He came to the U.S. for a family wedding in New York this summer. Waiting to be picked up at his hotel, his backpack was stolen with both of his passports in it. My living amends to him was to bring him back to Vermont, which was not planned, to help him get a new passport. He can at times be a tough guest, but I talked to my husband, prayed for love and tolerance, as we had no idea how long it would take. There happens to be an official U.S. passport office about an hour from where we live. So over 3 days, we worked on all the forms and then had an appointment on the fourth day. The love and tolerance part is important because he's 83. He's hard of hearing and a little wifty and very forgetful. So it took time to break all the steps down for and with him in doable chunks. In the end, he had a new passport, and on the fifth day, he got on a plane to go back to Peru. So that initial courage back in the spring allowed me to continue the process with true love and tolerance, which translated into service for him. So service is one of the principles, and that is going to be woven throughout these other principles that I'm talking about. So the next principle is hope. And in the book Daily, the AA book, Daily Reflections, on page 66, it says, all that step six asks of me is to become willing to name my defects, claim them as my own, and be willing to discard the ones I can just for today. And on page in the big book, it says, do not be discouraged. That's where the hope lies. How has this played out for me? My daughter, actually, she's the one who introduced me to 12 of years. She's had some job and relationship transitions and challenges. One of my character defects is asking too many questions. I'm also very good at asking questions. In fact, that's what my career was all about. And that's an example of how character defects can also be assets. She describes those like two people sitting side by side on a park bench and holding hands. So over these 2 years with relationship transitions and the job transitions, I had to learn, lean in heavily to my program to refrain from asking too many questions and allow things to unfold, and not pepper her with questions. When are you moving? How's the job search going? How's the relationship going? And on and on and on. And I think it probably sounds like to her or other people when I don't take the pause and refrain from asking those questions. Every morning on my early morning walk last fall during that very difficult time, I would pray, "Thy will, not mine, be done." Praying for help to wait, to refrain from asking. Sometimes I slipped, getting impatient for information. Further in that paragraph on page 60, it says, "The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection." And there's the hope, spiritual progress. So the next principle is love. Going back to my husband, love as one of the principles is captured so often in the big book, but we are given directions in the family afterward as to how to employ that in our families. Approaching this precious relationship with my husband requires faith and grace, rather than grit and determination, because that usually means trampling on him. As in any other relationship, we can drive each other crazy sometimes. My husband has a high degree of anxiety about a lot of things, one of them being driving in the snow, which you might think is odd since we live in Vermont, but that's just how it is. So one snowy day, not a blizzard, just a steady snow, I had a plan to drive about 20 minutes away to have breakfast with a friend. So as I was getting ready to go, he said, "Where are you going?" Even though it was on the calendar, I said, "To breakfast with Amy." "Well, you're not going. It's snowing." Well, when anyone says to me, you're not going to do something, my hackles get up, and my huffy self in my mind, you can imagine me about 14, anywhere from, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, put my hands on my hips in my mind and say, "You're not the boss of me." Here's where the spiritual principle came in. I paused, took a breath, tamped down that huffy kid and said, "You know what? I really appreciate your concern, and I'm still going to go, and I'll text you when I get there." And he said, "Okay." And that is actually the process that we've continued to this day. I love him for his concern because he's only concerned for my safety. Recovery helps me see that and get off. You can't be the boss of me or think anybody's trying to control me. On page 130 in the family afterward, it says, "We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness." That snowy day, with that pause, I was able to be of service, both my husband, me, and our relationship in deep love. So now I want to just comment a little bit on the family afterward. Jason and Rachel did a beautiful job of pulling some important passages out of the family afterwards. And as my closing part, I want to share a few parts of the family afterward and how those principles have played out. On page 123, it says, "Though old buildings will eventually be replaced with finer ones, the new structures will take years to complete." During the pandemic, I began Zooming with my two remaining brothers every week, and the pandemic happened right after my brother David died. So it was important for us to connect, and now we connect every month. In my 8.5 years in recovery, I have learned to be more tolerant and patient with these two. In other words, it takes years to build these new buildings. Before recovery, I would be controlling and wanting to be the fixer. As I approached these calls, I said the set-aside prayer and the St. Francis prayer before turning on Zoom. During the calls, I often said the third step prayer, repeating in my mind, "Relieve me of the bondage of self." Then in my nightly review, I might often write about any self-seeking or selfish thoughts I had had. On page 124, Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is to turn the past into good account. That's one of the promises, not to regret the past nor shut the door on it. My past informs my future. Most of my family relationship have been strengthened and enhanced by the past. It's not been an easy past, filled with many blunders which resulted in hurt, anger, suspicion, distrust, all the blunders from my own selfish motives. Now it is miraculous, and only because of a connection with my higher power and the gift given to me of honest reflection and introspection, that it is explored through my writing, prayer and meditation, and conversation with fellows. I try to follow the adages of, does it need to be said? Does it need to be said now? Does it need to be said now by me? As Leah said in the introduction, I am experiencing the joy of living, and program teaches me the actions needed to realize that joy. In closing, I am blessed to be married to a man who supports me completely in my recovery. This is a time-intensive program. Over the years, we have worked together on how to make it work for both of us. As a couple and with our kids, grandchildren, and extended family, recovery has only enhanced those relationships. One of my favorite quotes from the story Gutter Bravado is what guides me every day, and this is what it says. I'm not sure where my journey may take me. Next, I know I'll owe it to the grace of God and to the three words of the 12 steps. Continue, improve, and practice. And oh, one more thing. They told me humility is the key. And with that, I will pass, and I thank you for the opportunity to do this share.
Thank you, Phoebe B., for your profound share. Beautiful. Thank you to all three panelists, Jason and Rachel and Phoebe, so much for your beautiful, heartwarming, and vulnerable shares this morning. Today's share ID, 2091. That's 22091. Contact information for our panelists will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so please do stay tuned for that. We will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question to one of our panelists by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Robin P. in Costa Rica.
Robin.
Marisa G. New York.
Thank you, Toby Marisa.
Florida.
Toby W. Mm-hmm.
Janice P.M.
Gotcha, Janice.
Mm-hmm.
Marcia D. in Ohio.
Marcia D.
Leah F.
Thank you, Leah. Anyone else want to get in on this group?
Hanayeta R. in Texas.
Got you. Okay, thus far, Robin P., Marissa G., Toby W., Janice P.M., Marcia D., Leah S., and Hanayeta R. Okay, let's get started with Robin P. Questions only, please. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. Oh, my gosh, that was amazing. Thank you. Oh, wow, it's great. My husband and I were just listening with just rapt attention. Thank you all so much. What a blessing. My husband's also in recovery, so just such a gift. My question is for Phoebe and Jason, do you do any spiritual practices together on a daily basis? Do you do any 11-step work together? Thank you so much. God bless you guys. Sending a big hug.
Yeah, I can jump in. Thank you for the question. I do like a daily review with like gratitudes and what was I packing into the stream of life and, you know, selfishness, fear, dishonesty, just as described in the big book. And I email that to Rachel every day. It can be awkward sometimes if, like, I was resentful at Rachel for X, Y, and Z, but she usually knows that, and it's, like, something we share is, like, information, and she shares that with me. We haven't been great about meditating together, though we do that sometimes. I'm an early riser, and she's later, And then sometimes we just pray together. And then we have lots of spiritual discussions. You know, I try to tear apart certain program slogans and argue for the abolition of them. And she's like, well, Jason, it's kind of helpful. So we do our own little, like, you know, we do our own, you know, spiritual conversation, so to speak. And I'll pass if anybody else wants to speak to that.
I'm wondering, Robin, if you meant Rachel, since it was Jason and Rachel who are in recovery together.
Oh, Jason together. And Rachel. Sorry, that's what I meant to say. Oh, my gosh. Sorry.
Hey, this is Rachel KP. Yeah, thanks, Robin. Yeah, just, I mean, Jason, I think, said all of it. I'll just highlight, though, one of the things that we do is that, like, if we're on a phone call, we'll be like, do you have any 10 steps? Do you have any 10 steps? And, you know, if we don't have any 10 steps, we may share gratitudes. And we both, I send Jason my nightly review as well as to my sponsor and a few other fellows via email. But what we both did in our nightly review is that we put gratitudes at the top, even though that's not in the big book. That's something that's been really useful for us. And do you want to share any gratitudes or appreciations? And I think that's something that, regardless of whether people have a partner in recovery or not, you know, you can just say, like, do you have any gratitudes you want to share? And that's really, that's a great practice that we do as well.
Thank you, Robin P., for the question. Next up, Marissa G.
Thank you for hearing me. My question is actually for Phoebe. And I do want to thank all of the participants. It was wonderful today, and quite a unique view of recovery with a couple in recovery. I loved it. Phoebe, the very end of your testimony and your talk, you used humility is the key. Could you expound upon that? Could you also maybe bring in your experience, maybe when you really realize that humility was the key and how it has affected your program? Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks, Marissa, for the question. I think, you know, it's a little bit like the quote that I said about it. Sometimes it takes years to build a new building. Humility came for me kind of as a slow burn. It's not something that I was not struck humble. And it took the work through the steps. And as I said, you know, it's a progressive program. It's spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. And I could have moments of humility, but then I could go back to being that egotistical self. I think that, certainly, ego deflation helped a lot for me in developing humility, in seeing when I was wrong, being able to take enough of a pause with my husband, my brothers, my sister-in-law, you know, anybody in the family, my daughter, my stepdaughters, being able to take that pause allowed my higher power to help me to be more humble. And I think both Jason and Rachel referred to restraint of pen and tongue. And I can sometimes be a little bit too enthusiastic about responding to an email or responding to a text or picking up the phone and calling. And so that is one of the things that has helped me to take time to get feedback from a family member when I did respond too quickly. And I did have an experience with my daughter quite a few years ago when she was going to be in a recovery center, and I did my questioning thing, and she stopped communicating with me for a little while because I peppered her with too many questions through an email. And so it's through experience that humility grows. It's me accepting when I'm wrong, getting my hands off my hips in that 14-year-old, you're not going to be the boss of me, and pausing, taking a breath, walking away for a little while so that I can see what's my part. My nightly review is incredibly helpful in that, where I look at, did I have a resentment? Was I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, or afraid? And oftentimes in that nightly review, fear is at the root of whatever my resentment is. And that's very humbling. So it's an accumulation, Marissa, of experiences that brings me to knowing that humility is the key. So I hope that I answered your question, and thank you for the question.
Yes, thank you, Marissa G. Toby W., your turn.
Good morning. Thank you, all three of you, for your presentation. But my question is for Phoebe. This is Toby W., now living in Florida. And I moved to Florida from the Boston area to be closer to my oldest daughter, who requested that I do that so that I could get better help from her. She and I agreed to disagree more times than anything else, and I get frustrated. And I just don't know how to handle it so that I don't get into the food, get too angry and get into the food. So I don't know if you have any comments or not, Phoebe, with your experience with your adult children.
So Toby, as I understand this, your question is how do I deal with a relationship where we agree to disagree more than we agree, and how to, during those times, stay out of the food or any other unhealthy way of managing that discomfort, because it is discomfort. So there's a quote that a fellow shared with me, and I hope I can get it right, which is a quote that really helps me. And it is to bear the discomfort, comma, the comfort will come. And God is in the comma. God is in the pause between the comma and the next word. And that has been a wonderful guiding light for me, that it's bearing the discomfort, pausing, listening for my higher power. And sometimes my higher power comes through my writing. Sometimes it comes through talking to my sponsor. Sometimes it comes through talking to my fellows. And, this is a we program. This is not something that I do by myself. When I'm feeling that discomfort, and sometimes it's my husband that I talk to. He's great to talk to about these things, and he gets it. So it's reaching out for help that helps me to stay away from those unhealthy thoughts that perhaps eventually could lead to the food. They might. Thankfully, I've been out of the food for a long time. So Toby, I hope that's helpful to you, and I'll pass.
Thank you.
Thank you, Toby W., for your question. Janice PM. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm sorry I delayed. Yes, good morning to you, and a happy day to you. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I've been this a long time. My question is, we talk about the 12 spiritual principles in to get recovered. Now, there's more than 12 principles because there's three different parts, you know, for those of us that know about the traditions and the concepts. Now, when I hear you, it's wonderful. I hear the very first principle, spiritual principle of the traditions, which is unity. What a lucky son you have to have a mother and dad. So do you practice the principles of the traditions and the concepts? Can you give me an example how you do it? If you know, if you have, I appreciate that. To anybody, anyone that knows about that, because I'd like to know. I know very little, but do you understand the question?
Yeah, thank you, Janice. Like the spiritual principles, yeah, spiritual principles go beyond just what the big book and says and, you know, the traditions within the 12 and 12s and then, you know, these 12 spiritual principles. I don't put a lot of stock into, you know, there's a tradition of, you know, our common welfare comes first. You know, like I think Rachel and I think in that way generally, you know, yeah. But we don't necessarily mm-hmm. study the traditions, you know, so like we have an old car. And the old car is dying, and I'm like, well, I want to buy a new car, but Rachel's driving the car that I bought, and so which is a great interest rate, but I'm like, well, what's going to help the whole family? Because I want to go buy, you know, the sports car, and I want to buy the Porsche, but it's not going to support our family. Like, our common welfare means I have to ask Rachel, what does our budget look like? What do our expenses look like? You know, she's coming back to work after not working for a little while and building a private practice. So, you know, if I say, well, you know, let me drive the car that you're driving, which I bought, but she's driving, then she has to buy a whole new car and get a new payment, which is likely to be higher. So it's like, so I'm thinking, well, either I just suck it up and drive this old car until it really dies, or if I buy a new car, she keeps the really nice, cozy financial agreement of her driving my old car. So it's always about, you know, thinking in a greater aspect of, you know, in towards like deeper principles. But I don't explicitly sort of study those principles and then say, oh, here we're going to practice them. I think they just come throughout it. But I don't know if anybody else has anything to add.
Well, thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Janet.
I'd like to speak to that.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Rachel. Hey, this is Rachel KP. Thanks for the question. I think when it comes to the principles and the concepts, I think they are, you know, they are important aspects of the program. But, you know, when I hear the word principles, I think the steps, right? Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry but it says we practice these principles in all our affairs, right? I think many of us know that Bill W. like took certain words and like used them in the book like interchangeably with other words and things like that. So when I hear principles, I think steps, right? And I think that's the message for me of this panel is like when we say principles, I think we mean like practicing the steps in like spiritual principles, practicing the steps and what comes out of working the steps in our lives. In our families. I think it's important not to like overcomplicate things. You know, I know I've spoken with some people who have done like, you know, just like you would work the steps 1 through 12, they work the traditions 1 through 12, right? And I've never done that personally, I might in the future, but I think as a result of working the steps, then the principles, you know, become real in our lives, right? And when I think the principles also, I think, you know, the OA 12 and 12 outlines like the spiritual principle for this step is this, right? So I think as a result of working that step, you then live that principle. So it's, for me, it's all just all about working the steps and not needing to overcomplicate things.
Thank you for the question, Janice PM. Marcia D, your turn. Star one to unmute.
Good morning, OA family, and thank you, panelists, for all your wonderful shares. My question is for Phoebe. Since your spouse is not in recovery, have you had times where you've gotten maybe some pushback in regard to what you need to do daily to support your recovery? Have there been kind of challenges? And if so, how do you work with those? Thank you.
Because I've been doing this for a long time, I can, rewind back to the beginning. and it was hard at the beginning, but he'd been through so much with me about my weight, my unhappiness. I mean, he was willing to do anything. The time aspect of it was a bit challenging at first, because I need to make 3-4 phone calls a day, 3 to Fellows and 1 to my sponsor. I need to eat certain foods. I need to, do my reading and writing every day. And it takes a lot of time. So at the beginning, some of the pushback did have to do with the food. He liked having snacks around, chips and cookies and things like that. And that was hard. And so I asked him to put those in places where I wouldn't be able to see them. And he'd forget sometimes and he'd leave them out on the counter. And I got frustrated having to ask him to put them somewhere else. But over time, I'm just going to go back to that same quote that I talked about before, about it taking years to build a building, a strong building. So over these, I've actually been in program for 9.5 years. Over those 9.5 years, so many changes have happened. And my husband eats what I eat. I cook for both of us now. When he wants to get cookies, he gets cookies. When he goes to the grocery store, we've worked out a way to do the grocery shopping. We have it divided. And if he wants to get special treats for himself, then he gets them and he has a place where he puts them. And he doesn't have to put them out of the kitchen. It's gotten to the place now where there's a corner in our counter where I can't really see the cookies. And it almost doesn't even matter anymore. But there are certain things that I can't handle seeing. Like if we go hiking and he buys a particular kind of candy to have as a snack afterwards, I'll remind him, I'll say, you know, that is the one that it's really hard for me. And he'll go, he's a wonderful person. He'll go back in the store and he'll exchange it. And so just like I said, how humility grows, it's a slow progress. And it was slow for us, but we've worked it out. I'm a very early morning person. So I do most of my calls early in the morning before he's even awake. My sponsor call is while he's having breakfast. And we don't normally have breakfast together. We have other meals together. And it's working out beautifully. And it's the same thing with our family. I've been doing this for so long now that, you know, my daughters will call and say, this is what I was thinking about making. Is that something you can eat? Or how can we adapt it so that you can eat it? But that wasn't the case at the beginning. So it's always being willing to be honest and vulnerable and not let the resentment grow. So I hope that helps, Marcia.
Thank you, Marcia. Our final question for this morning comes from Leah S.
Thank you so much, Leah.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much, Jason and Rachel. My question is for Rachel. Do you find that not doing a 10-step, but empathizing, and I'm referring to washing the dishes when you disagreed on certain aspects. Where did you come to the conclusion that it wasn't necessary at that point. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the question. This is Rachel KP. You know, just this is just for me. You know, as a result of doing the work for several years, my thinking has changed, right? I'm able to access God, you know, faster or, you know, quicker than I would if I were on in recovery. You know, could I have done a 10th step? Would it have been a great thing to do? Absolutely. But just because for the sake of time, I didn't. I think for me, if it had kind of stuck with me for, and I was ruminating on it and thinking about it, and it was causing me like to be restless, irritable, and discontent, right, for a little bit longer, I would have done a 10th step. That's just me. For I do 10 steps if something's rolling over in my mind over and over again, and I can't let it go, and it's, you know, it's not passing, right, with quickly, like, so that's how I determine whether to do a 10 step, but that's just me.
Thank you, Leah S. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning, and of course, thank you to our panelists, Jason KP, Rachel KP, and Phoebe B. Thank you for your honesty, such rich and profound shares of experience, strength, and hope on how you lay these principles in all facets of your life, especially your family relationships. Thank you so very much. The share ID for today, 22,091. That's 22091. And we're going to close this meeting now from a chapter entitled A Vision for You, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.